in conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast, which is sponsored by Presto Music, the UK's leading e-commerce site for classical and jazz recordings. With over 70,000 jazz recordings and more than 35,000 music books to browse and purchase online, Presto offers an extensive catalogue to suit members and jazz lovers. And there's a website, Dan.
Yes, I love a website.
You do love a website.
I do.
Presto Music, PRESTOMusic.com/jazz.
Great. I'm going to have a look now.
How are your websites going?
Yeah, they're going all right. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Just doing the music one mainly.
Excellent. Excellent. Some of my students have been using Presto Music this week.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, delivering value.
Yeah, absolutely.
What did they use it for?
My student, and I have an adult who's been ordering a lot of books online.
Yeah.
When I told her about the sponsorship, she was just like, oh, yeah, great. I use Presto all the time.
Great.
Oh, honestly, nice. That did happen. And I forget someone else had used it for something as well last week.
Mm.
Yeah, it's happening. Mate, better than using Amazon.
Delivering value.
Yeah, big time. So on the Jazz Podcast today, we have Tim Kliphouse, who is a violinist who, I'm begrudged to admit, lives in the EU.
Why are you begrudged?
Because I want to live in the EU. Yeah, does that work in that context if I say I'm begrudged?
I don't know. We'll let people decide.
Okay.
I think I know what you meant, but I don't know if that was the correct.
Okay. That would be a surprise if it didn't work at all. Tim is a Dutch. He's renowned for mixing gypsy jazz with classical and folk music. When I read stuff like that, I never believe it. But when I listened to Tim, honestly, I was like, oh, he's really done it.
He gets
he's
it.
Really, mm. Yeah, he's really tried to offend a lot of people. And I love
it. He's in good company then.
He's in very good company. Absolutely. So before we start, I'm going to play one of his tracks. This is called Earth. This is off his album, The Five Elements, which was released last year in 2020. And our old pal Tara Minton is going to be on the interview as well.
So. Oh, great. Good old Tara. Where is she? I miss her.
She's actually babysitting right now. She's texted me. Tell you what. I'm going to send her the Zoom link and then let's do the outro.
Great.
Let's get Tara in right now. All right.
Wonderful.
All right. Here it comes. This is Earth. Thank you. I am here with Tim Cliphouse and Tara Minton. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm fine, and thank you, Rob, for having me.
It's our pleasure. How are you, Tara?
Yeah, I'm great.
Excellent. Let's talk about jazz.
Yes. Tim, do you want to start telling us just a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, with pleasure. Rather a long time ago, I was studying classical violin in Amsterdam, and I got given a CD of a guy called Stefan Grappelli, a French violinist who played jazz. And I was really, I fell in love with his music. And he was playing not only himself, but with a Django Reinhardt guitar genius from Paris. And we call this gypsy jazz nowadays. Back in the day, it was called hot club jazz. And I just started learning that on the side, didn't ever study it at a conservatoire or anything, but just did my own research and was very lucky to live in Holland, which has a big community of gypsy jazz players through the Sinti community, which is a branch from the gypsy tribe, which has, there are two branches, the Sinti and Roma, and the Sinti gypsies happen to have fallen in love with Django's music a little bit before me. So they were all at it. There were a few very, very big names from Holland already. The Rosenberg Trio was one and Fappy Laffertin was the other. And I was lucky enough to have 5 years with Fappy on the road in his band, recording three CDs, etc. So that was kind of my background. I became, as a classical player, and I completed my master's and everything, full classical thing, my kind of sideline became jazz, and the touring, etc., was all practical. I was basically apprenticing to him, and then after that, I considered myself a jazz violinist.
Amazing. And so when did you form your own trio, breaking away from Fappy and, you know, doing your own thing?
Yeah, well, 5 years after we started working together, I'd kind of seen the circle. Gypsy jazz has quite a limited circuit worldwide. There are festivals, and of course now it's grown a lot since the days that I was playing with Fappy, which is the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. But even now it's still very defined, and I was frustrated that I was not using my classical background at all. So I decided I need to at least start playing my own repertoire, and I broke away in 2004-5 kind of, and made a first album with some session guys in London, including Len Skeet, who was the bass player for Grappelli in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
Yep. So I heard lots of stories about the great man, and I actually did get to meet Grappelli and play for him in 1970.
Did you?
Yeah. I was very, very lucky that my bandmate badgered me into going on a drive 800 kilometers all the way to Munich, because he was only performing a couple of times a year at that stage. He was 87 years old.
Wow.
And that was 2 years before his death. So I was very, very lucky that my bandmate just organized it and booked a hotel, and we drove there, and I got to meet him and got some good advice as well. Anyway, that kind of his advice, which was basically to say, do your own thing. Just don't just copy me, because I'm allowed to play me. I invented this stuff, but you're living now, you know, so don't be an archaeologist or an archivist or a museum person. So that was in my mind. But with Fappy, I was very traditionally playing gypsy jazz the way that Django and Stefan played it in the 30s, 40s. Mm-hmm. Of course, we did some of our own tunes, but it was very, in sound, it was very, very much the old thing, which is great. Don't get me wrong. But I needed to develop, and so after my first CD which was recorded in London, I was kind of touring in Britain, the circuit, the jazz circuit, the clubs, where they have rhythm sections waiting for you and you can just travel as a soloist. But I also did a few dates in Scotland, and there I met two guys, Roy Percy, bass player, whom I instantly befriended, and also Nigel Clark, a guitarist, very, very fine, world-class guitarist, who was at the time living in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. So we did a few dates, and that kind of clicked. So a year later, I got a tour of the Highlands, and I phoned those guys up, and that was the start of the trio, and that was 15 years ago. We've never looked back.
Yes, And I got to see you perform at the Cambridge Jazz Festival, and it was wonderful.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Which year was that Cambridge Jazz Festival, Tim?
Ha, you're asking me. Tara?
I believe it was 2018, November 2018.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Can I ask, Tim, you know, you were saying that you were frustrated when you started playing jazz that you weren't using any of your, like, classical technique, the things that you'd learned. Do you think, though, that it made you a much better, like, technically accomplished violinist, having studied so much classical music first? Like, has it helped you in your jazz career to have done all of that work?
Absolutely, and that's exactly also the reason that I was frustrated, because there are all these things that you can do that maybe if you're playing in one particular style, you don't address, you don't use them. So you're basically using just a part of your technique and of your sound world, because that's another thing. The sound of a particular jazz era is defined, and then you just do that sound. But there are many other sounds. I'm not just talking about notes. I'm talking about the way you use your instrument, the tone of your violin, the tone that you get if you play accents a different way, or the kind of swing that you use, the kind of repertoire. Do you groove? Do you swing? There are so many things, and most players end up in a style and then doing that for the rest of their lives. And I kind of thought, well, I've been so well equipped. I have so much stuff at my disposal and a knowledge, a very broad knowledge of classical music. I think Amsterdam was probably an ideal place for me to learn. I'm sorry about that. Somebody phoned me there. Just turn my phone.
Good to know. One of us is busy. Yeah,
it's live. I thought if I I'm really not using all that, but I will be able to find it if I go and search for it. So and that actually created my style. And since I merged what I know from classical and what I know from jazz and the few things I learned meeting folk legends and working with Irish and Scottish Celtic players, which is another love of mine, that's when I kind of really had a career, because you don't really have a career playing somebody else's music, like the tribute to Miles Davis or the tribute to Stefan Grappelli. That's nice for a while. You can get your first gigs and it defines which sound world you're doing, which is good for the first audiences. But after that, you just keep going around in circles.
Mm. Yeah, I feel like the art form's not going to progress very far if we like.
Exactly.
I see there's quite a lot of that at the moment. And when I was at college, there was a lot of advice about that. Like you say, for your first gigs, for your first album, if you do a tribute to someone else, it's going to really help.
Yeah.
Can I ask you another thing? That I had a conversation with a friend once, because I, similar to you, studied classical saxophone before and did like a degree in classical saxophone before I sort of converted to jazz. And when I was studying jazz, I had a talk with my friend Joe, who said to me, he was like asking me, Rob, I want you to find me some like contemporary classical saxophone stuff to play, because I really want to look into that. And I was like, why on earth would you want to do that? You know, there's not loads of repertoire, and like you're already doing what I want to do, which is playing jazz and improvising. And he said, the thing about contemporary classical music is you have to be good when the music demands you to be and how it demands. You know, there's like this bar maybe coming towards you and it's hard. Yep. You know, and he was like, my problem with jazz is I only play within what I can already do, you know.
Correct.
And it got me thinking, like it was one of the first times, sounds a bit foolish, I know, but it's one of the first times I sort of started looking back thinking, this is interesting that somebody else could look at the way I've studied and think there was like an advantage to it, that I hadn't just played jazz, you know, for my whole upbringing.
Yeah, no, these are really, really good points you're touching on. I just want to reply to your first or comment on your first one, that you're getting advice at a conservatoire. Of course, the word conservatoire means conserve. It means go look back, right? So they're usually, the conservatoires are always behind the musicians, just like the audiences are. But musicians actually have the job to take things forward. And the conservatoires don't really push you to do that all the time. Like I think Paul McCartney said, if the Beatles had gone to a conservatoire, we would never have been successful, because we were successful because we found things out in our attics and tried stuff and just had no fear for whatever the future we had. We were just dumb kids, you know?
Yeah.
And so then what do you do if you're a dumb kid? You go for stuff that you you're interested in. And conservatoires are moving towards this gradually, but they'll always be behind the times. And I think that's okay. It's you're learning a trade. It's just like carpentry. If you're a carpenter, you learn to make things the old-fashioned way, great, and then you forge your own style. And that's what every musician should do. And a conservatoire can be a fantastic tool for that. But the advice to go out and do a tribute because it will sell things more is great advice for your first album, but it's not great advice for your second album. So where's that going to go? And the thing with the idiom of jazz and the notes, and the same goes for classical music, by the way, the notes, the incredible number of leading notes and out chords that way of playing has reached a limit, just like classical music reached a limit with Arnold Schoenberg. And so what's happening now is that the only way forward is to go back into the combination of styles and not say I'm a specialist, which is a stupid idea from the 20th century. That's the specialist century. But before that, 19th, 18th, 17th century, nobody considered themselves specialists. They usually played numerous instruments. They arranged, composed, conducted, whatever, performed, talked about music. These were people who are like rounded artists. Look at Mozart. Look at Liszt. All the tricks he did with his manager to get audiences to become hysterical. I mean, that was the first Facebook campaign was with Liszt's career. And so there are so many more things to it than just being a very good soloist who can play Sibelius. And that's a 1900s concept that's now gone. And I think that's a good thing. I think we need to have a lot of respect for everybody who really masters something. So he does, you or, you know, somebody else goes back to the past and looks at recordings and talks to musicians who've had their careers, learns a lot from that, and then thinks, okay, well, now I'm going to do this thing because that's what I like. I think that aspect in conservatoires is a little bit underrepresented, and I'm very, very proud and also grateful that Amsterdam is offering this improvisation master, which is in the classical department. So it's not a jazz degree. It's not a classical degree. You improvise, you compose, you present yourself as a fully-fledged creative musician. I don't think there's something like this anywhere else in the world at the moment. There will be, but I think they're the first.
That's really interesting. My friend Lindsay is writing a PhD at the moment, like a doctorate at the Guildhall in classical improvisation.
Right.
But I think in that case, this isn't really inaccurate to say, but, you know, in that context, she's kind of trying to be the one that's leading the research because there's not that much.
Yeah.
There's not, like you say, there's not many people I'm aware of that you can go to and be like, I want to learn about this. But as far as I was aware, like you say, back in the time of Mozart, like a cadenza in a concerto would have been completely improvised. And yet that seems to be gone from our culture now.
Yeah, I think it's coming back, actually. What I see is the reason of it disappearing is because the 20th century was about making the most money possible out of classical music or music in general. Mm-hmm. And so you get pigeonholing because that's the quickest way to sell. So you publish a score and you say this is the only way it can be played, which in Bach's eyes would be absolutely ridiculous, because if he were to play something from 20 years ago, he'd revise it. He'd go, ah, that's shit. I'm going to change that. And the same for Mozart. These guys didn't see their music as set in stone. And people in the 1900s have been selling it like that. And we've had, even in the 70s, we've had this massive revival where we went back to the urtexts, to the original handwriting, and somebody just dropped his pen on the paper, and that means something, you know. Come on, they would be laughing at us if they saw us like this. And so that happened. And then, of course, we had the recording industry, which was the next thing that further pigeonholed everything, because you need to market it on the radio or on television or in the newspaper, and you need to describe what it is. So suddenly we're not talking about musicians. We're talking about classical musicians. We're talking about Baroque musicians. We're talking about modern jazz. We're talking about whatever. The new jazz crossover, whatever it is, jazz funk that Jean-Luc Ponty was making with the Mahavishnu Orchestra when he was there. I don't know. Suddenly, and that says, it says it like it doesn't, it's not allowed to do that and something else, you know? Like, okay, well, I just play this, but I also, and thankfully, we do have people who go against that, like Chick Corea, who just passed, sadly. He would play Mozart and Gershwin in one concert and just sort of...
Yes, I saw Tim play in Norway about 10 years ago, and yeah. He came out with a Scarlatti score.
Yeah.
Sorry, saw Chick play, yeah. And I was like, at the time, I was like mind blown. I was like, what, you know, and he's like played a few of his tunes. The way he'd like just like... He obviously saw music as something where it was all interconnected in a way that, as
that's,
a kid...
That's no different from the way that Duke Ellington or Nina Simone saw it. It's just, mm-hmm. There's good and bad music, as Duke said. And that's the, for me, my real heroes, my real greats were all like that. Even Stefan Grappelli, who played a very clearly sort of style with boundaries, if you can call it that. But he was always playing with other guys outside the style. He did his Uni Menuhin project, and he played with Frankie Gavin, my mate from Ireland. And there's so much stuff that he was interested in. So he was open-minded. Uni Menuhin was definitely open-minded. He was the best thing that happened to the classical world in the 20th century, with opening up to the classical audience what other music there is besides violin concertos and piano concertos. So there are through the last century, there are dotted a large number of people who've proven this point, and they're all greats, all of them.
It sounds like the greats really embrace what it means to play, you know, because as children, we play and we create and we explore without boundaries. It's just curiosity, you know, unbounded. And all of the greats seem to have that. And it's interesting that you go to conservatoires and they try to put boundaries around that. And it's, I'm glad that that's starting to come down, particularly in Amsterdam. It sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what we are going to see in the future, and Amsterdam is already, I sort of floated this past the director recently, and he confirmed that that's the way they're starting to think now, is that you see somebody who comes to you, is a great player. Amsterdam only works with very, very high level musicians. So people who get in there are really good. And then you see this player and you go, what do they need? Are they going to be an orchestral player? Are they going to be a jazz player? Are they going to need to be in the studio? Or are they going to do other stuff? Do they need to talk about their music? More research. And then you find the tutors that this person needs. So you're more like a production house. That's the future
amazing.
Of conservatoires.
Because well, so many... Oh, go on, Rob.
Sorry, I was just going to add to this, Tim, that I studied at the Royal Northern in Manchester on a saxophone degree, but there isn't a jazz course or a classical course. You just do exactly that. You go as a saxophone player. What do you need? There's no like, you know, I played like concerto for Stan Getz, a Richard Rodney Bennett piece. Like my final recital, the second movement is like filled with improvising. It's supposed to be like a classical course, but I'm not like playing in that way.
Yeah.
At all. And I'm not being marked down for it either. Like the open-mindedness was amazing. But I feel like that's because the saxophone is only like 150 years old. It's much easier with an instrument that's not crushed by its own history to come at it and have that open-mindedness. But like, how do you like push back with the violin against all the history? I mean, you must offend a lot of people.
Well, to start with, I was very interested to see how that worked, because in the gypsy jazz scene, of course, the violin was part of the sound. So I was always the sidekick, you know, of some guitars, because it's a guitar-driven scene. So also that for me was another reason why I thought, okay, I have to leave this, because I also have something to say here for myself. Then I went into the British jazz scene, and playing those clubs with the in-house rhythm sections, what really struck me was how often I had to convince the band, who were sometimes very good players, sometimes not good at all, how I had to convince them that a violin was not going to be just, you know, Humpty Dumpty, oh, let's all have a laugh, and oh, yes, we'll play some simple Grappelli tunes, and then we all go home and et cetera, have a cup of tea. That was actually some serious jazz going to be happening. And so I even devised a route for this. I would not rehearse with them. and I would give them the chart, and then I would say, okay, this is the beginning for this tune. That tune we start sort of half tempo, and then we double up. I could just give me a break there, and I would start with a sort of easy swinger, which wouldn't give too much away, and then the next tune would be very, very fast. I would make them play very fast. And what often happens with the violins, that a violinist used to in the old days count off very fast, and then they couldn't handle the tempo that they set. That was our reputation. Also, the reputation for the violin was we just play these long, long notes, and we play all the time, and we don't know the chords. So basically, everything's wrong, which is in a way true. I mean, it's in a way deserved, because a great number of players were like this. Amateur players would sit in a jam session, everybody would have to cover their ears. Now, I'm not saying that was not the case for some saxophone players, but the percentage of good players was much higher. But by the time I'd played my fast tune, which some of them would have only just managed to hold on to the tempo, then I would have their respect. But how sad is that, that there's kind of a scene where, or the music scene in general, where something outside the box is already suspect the moment it arrives in your room, you know. That's very weird. Instead of just going, well, let's see what this is, you know, I'm interested to see what's going to happen. There was negativity there at the start. So my mission since then has also been for teaching to ensure that everybody who sees my materials, my videos, books, and also the live lessons and all this stuff, especially now that I'm doing lots of online teaching, that these people will learn at least those points. Try and play like a jazz player. Understand what you're doing. Get the sound right. And don't be a dumb sort of person playing long notes going la, la, la all through a beautiful rhythm section. So, but it was just so crazy having to fight that at the start. Really crazy.
Man, yeah. I completely, I obviously deal with that a lot as a harpist.
Yep.
And that's what I really loved about that lesson we had together, was to have somebody meeting me with curiosity about how can we find sounds, how can we work with this, rather than it's not part of our culture, it's not part of the history or the sound, so go and play Debussy.
Yeah.
You know, it was so refreshing, and it's frustrating, and it is changing, but it is frustrating to be met with, you know, as you say, Rob, just the wall of the weight of history.
Yeah, I don't get it, because it's the same with gender. It's the same with race. It's like we're supposed to be a very open-minded, curious industry, but so many people I talk to have like a lot of boundaries and a lot of like, resistance against the idea that they might do anything that's not, you know, part of the like straight ahead, hard swinging norm.
Do you feel that with teenagers too?
No, not at all.
I have a feeling this new generation is so on it with regards to race, gender, but yeah, also music. They're if you look at their playlists, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
I hope you're right. Well, I know you're right. I'm excited for these teenagers to grow up.
I am seeing it. I'm also seeing it in the conservatoires, where, of course, now in Amsterdam I've worked for 5 years, and even in those I visited before, so let's say I've seen 10 years of conservatoire material come by, and the willingness and speed with which string players now embrace improvisation techniques and just go and do it and learn quickly as well and understand chords. They still have had the same sort of in one ear, out the other theory, that they don't have any theory. None of them do. They just play lines, la, 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 la. That's violin and cello land. But they come to the class and they learn stuff and they retain it. And it's so much quicker than 10 years ago. Even these 10 years, I've seen a massive shift in how open and how able people are to embrace new things. So, with the upcoming teenagers, I have no doubt that there's just going to be a very open-minded and hopefully also a very sustainable outlook on our existence on this planet, because that's actually, we can talk about lots of things and music and worries, but there's, in this crisis, that's shown me there's only one worry, and that's how we're messing this planet up. Mm-hmm. That's why we have this crisis as well. So the new kids seem to be very focused on that. We don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to have to clear up some of the mess that our parents and our generations created.
Mm. So this might be a good time to talk about your new record, The Five Elements, because this is what the record is about. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what happened was, of course, I was on tour in Russia. I'm playing with an orchestra, some of my own music, and I was where was I? I was in Kazan, which is in Tatarstan, which is a part of southern province of Russia. And it was a four-date festival. And after the first date, basically everything in Europe was already closed and Russia was starting to get hectic. So that was sort of mid-March. Mm-hmm. Was it? Yeah, something like that, 20th, 22nd. And so they got me on one of the last planes back to Europe, thankfully. And so I sat at home and for 3 days I thought, what the blazes am I going to do? Because I knew then that was going to be a long-term thing. I'd researched the virus thing and what happens when you get a flu going around like this. It just takes 2.5 years. So I said, okay, 2.5 years, right? What am I going to do about this? So the first thing I thought was I need to get money to compose because that is something I can do that doesn't require me touring, going on an airplane or on a boat or on a something. Thing that I decided to do was write a piece that already the trio we had already explored the November before in 2019. And people were reacting to very, very well. They loved what we were sort of showcasing. It's a new style for us. As a trio, we've always made steps. And this step was to employ more minimal music patterns in our playing. So not base it on the soloing, but actually have a solo, an improvisation as a little interlude and have a lot of sort of prepared rhythmic stuff to create some kind of a sound world that we used very sparingly before. And I thought if we make that the basis for a new piece, that's exciting for us. So it's just a challenge for ourselves. And so I was already starting or had already started composing this piece, and I had decided to call it The Five Elements. The four that you know, earth, wind, water, fire, and then a fifth one, which there's a Greek concept of an element called quintessence, and that element has the characteristics of the four other elements in it. So it's like a combination of the other four. So I like that idea because musically, then you can do something with that because musically you can then have four different movements and a fifth that kind of recaps not like an overture, but a finale sort of. I thought, well, this has to be about our future because of course, if you see what's wrong at the moment with water, with air pollution, water, lots of flooding, fire, bushfires, forest fires, etc. That's a very good metaphor for a problem that I obviously wasn't new for me, but I thought this crisis puts it very much in perspective. And so as a composer, I felt the obligation, responsibility to use my music to make a little bit more aware the people who came to my concerts or listened to my albums. So that's it. That's the piece. It's about the problems. And the fifth movement is actually kind of a hopeful movement that gives a sort of upbeat to, okay, so how can everyone individually do something small? And in that way, not be cynics, and we can do all of us do something and a few things, maybe five, like the five elements. For instance, I started picking up plastic, especially since the pandemic. I've been picking up masks all over the place. Bloody hell! That's really terrible environmental disasters that we are now using masks that we throw away. I think there are millions floating in the ocean right now. As a result of the pandemic. So just little things. I completely stopped eating meat. My daughter, one of our daughters is eats in the vegan kind of diet because of this. And I decided to join her and not sort of have the very little meat that I used to have at all anymore. So just things like that, that can have a little impact. And then not just do that, but also talk to other people about it, like I'm doing now. So yeah. People can think about, okay, well, if America this is in a documentary, it's very interesting, it's called Game Changers. If the America, North American people were all to stop eating meat, which of course is a fantasy, but a nice fantasy, then we free up, we said planet's full, right? But then we free up a land mass the size of the continent of Africa, just because animals are not being raised, because we don't need the water for them, the corn and all the stuff that they get fed. Amazing. So that's the biggest game changer for me, is just if we really all start changing our diet in a good way. So some people will probably need meat for, you know, but think about it. Think about it. And for goodness sakes, let's vote for green parties and not for idiots that are running our governments right now. Excuse me.
No. You're talking to the choir.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, so that's what the piece was about. And I fundraised massively. So I got from all over the world, we got donations and we got support from our local council, who, of course, like any council, were struggling how to express their worries about the fact that all these musicians, self-employed musicians, are in trouble. The orchestra's all still funded in Holland, so people that just have jobs and sometimes come and do a project for nobody in a hall for a camera, which to me is very weird right now because everybody else is sitting on their hands. But they're the lucky ones now, which is fair play to them. They've gone through enough cuts and budget cuts as it is, and mergers. But all the unemployed people, so the council and some other funds chipped in. So the whole CD was produced without it costing any musician. Even musicians got paid. It cost nobody a penny, which is the first time for me. Usually I finance my own CDs and then we sell them on tour, and then that raises the money for new CDs and we kind of, you know, generate income that way. But no touring. We did manage to actually premiere it live. We had three days, so six shows. And there, of course, the first ones were just socially distanced. And then the next week, we only were allowed 30 people in the halls. So that reduced those 2 days. But we did it. We got it off the ground. And since then, it's been, we've made a little film.
Yes. Tell us about the film.
Yeah, well, that was another thing. We thought, well, we're fundraising. Let's try and keep things going because we're not going to be able to play this live at all. And I do want this message to be heard. So we made a 2.5-minute video that we shared on Facebook and stuff. But more importantly, we wanted to reach the 15 to 30-year-olds who are all talking and thinking about this right now, and give them a cultural way of looking at it, an artistic way, a statement. So we shared it on Instagram, and I don't know how many tens of thousands it reached, but lots and lots and lots. And I'm taking it to schools as well. My first school online school visit is going to be in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show the film and then discuss with the school kids. This is 15-year-olds. Discuss what their feelings are and how they feel about this. The problems we are facing, and also what they think they could do. And then I'm going to ask them to share this in videos. And the videos will be my inspiration for my next big piece, which I'm writing. So in that way, I've kind of created a series of compositions that are fueling one another.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I was really inspired by what is her name? Marietta Landkrum?
Yes, Landkrum. Yeah.
Yeah. I was really inspired by, she said, art can give people hope.
Yeah.
And she was talking about becoming a new mother and how much this project meant to her.
Yeah. And she's, by the way, she's the filmmaker. So she's the one who kind of planned and made the film that's being shown now. It's on my website. It's on my YouTube. So you can easily find it. It's just called The Five Elements.
And how did you meet Marietta?
Through a mutual friend, and I kind of was asking around and saying, well, I need youngish people, you know, young 30-year-olds to do this project, to do this film, and who like music, so who are into music themselves.
Yeah.
And because what I did was, we didn't only do that, we also had the town poet of Hilversum write poems. So she wrote five quatrains, which is four-line poems.
Mm-hmm.
With each element. So each element has its own poem, which we then translated to English as well. And those were read out during the concerts, and that was special as well. And at the premiere, she was reading them out herself. But we can do that obviously on tour when I'm able to do this again with the trio. We'll be playing this piece a lot, and I'll be reading out the poems. So it actually becomes more of a big sort of Gesamtkunstwerk, like Wagner, who I don't like very much. But anyway, Wagner was into that. You know, it's like the building. You build the building to do the operas, and then you build the stage so that it's massive, and you build the orchestra, and you make the music massive, and you make the cast massive, and the performance massive, and then everybody's very impressed. I'm not too into that, but I'm into the having the whole package and the visual and the word and the sound element meet. And it's the first time for me, so I'm very excited about that all.
You know, we're having a big conversation in the UK about creating space, particularly in the jazz scene, because it tends to be quite male and quite white and also quite old.
Right.
And I love what you're talking about, going into schools and asking young people how they feel about the planet and then creating space through your composition to, you know, give voice to what they're saying.
Share it, yeah.
Yeah, it's really important that we listen to young people because often their voices are dismissed because of a lack of life experience, say.
Yeah, and I'm very frustrated right now that new elections are in a month's time. I'd love them to be in a year or 2 years' time when these kids are able to vote, because they're going to make the right choices, I think, or at least better choices. I see very many people still voting on party. Our main party that goes for oil, it goes for Shell and KLM, and which is, of course, it's important that we have an airline, because I have to fly if I'm to tour in America. Then I can't get there by train. At the same time, when I tour, I try to be sustainable. So with the trio, we're in one car and we drive from one venue to the other, and we do a 10-day tour just in the one car. So that's how we try and keep our miles down. And yes, unfortunately, if you're playing live, you can't not have a carbon footprint. But first of all, you can offset it, and secondly, you can try and make it as sustainable as possible. So not fly somewhere for a weekend and then come back. Mm-hmm. So, but if flying gets too expensive, cool, then I'm going to just tour in Europe. That's fine too. And go to Britain, hopefully with a boat. But what we should be doing is not financing those guys. We should make those guys smaller and finance the guys who really need it, and not the old. In Holland, it's incredible. We are the number one exporter of meat to the United States. Would you believe it? Our tiny little country, it's a postage stamp size. Somehow we've packed these animals in mega sort of, it's like, I don't know, big sheds, rows and rows of them. And there they are in horrible circumstances. And all that meat's going to America. We should stop doing that. We should just use the country, you know, in a normal way, in a sustainable way.
Yeah.
And so it's and that industry is getting financed. That's my problem. It's getting subsidized, and that creates a very bad incentive to be bad. Incentive is to be good, then things are going to go the right way. But that's not our current prime minister. He's not interested in that, sadly.
I did see a very uplifting, I think it was a YouTube video about the Netherlands, and you're one of the biggest exporters of vegetables and fruit as well.
Yep.
And you have these great greenhouses. They're like bunk beds for and that's one of the problems with crops, is that obviously it can ruin the soil. And if you have, you know, masses and masses of fields of corn, say, then you can't continually grow corn on that field year in, year out, because it ruins the soil.
You have to rotate.
Yeah. And it's amazing, because the Netherlands isn't a huge country, and you have these giant sleepovers of vegetables and
pajama parties. Pajama parties.
Absolute bananas in pajamas.
Nice. You're onto something here.
Well, you guys are. It's fantastic. It really inspired me. So, because like everyone, I've become a lockdown cliche and I grow vegetables.
Yep. Good.
As everybody should.
You're even wearing your apron, I see.
Oh, no, it's...
I'm joking. It's
just for the exactly listeners. Like one.
Cara is wearing her apron and she's also got wellies on. Her boots are on. She's just outside in Pink Garden.
I've embraced being British.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, I know that obviously.
Have you the Great British Grow Off yet? Is that going to happen soon?
We should do that.
Yeah.
We tried to get that going on my street last year, but it didn't quite happen. But I think I might push for it this summer.
Yeah. And then you can do research and you can play the vegetables, different types of music, and then see which ones really make them grow. You see?
Yeah.
That's where the funding comes from.
That's yeah. where the funding comes from. Our funding.
Research element. Absolutely.
Well, I'm growing my vegetables in the front garden this year because it's south facing. And I've bought big whiskey barrels to
oh, wow.
to make, you know, most of the space so I can grow in levels.
And the vegetables taste of Drambuie or you have some nice Oban flavored salad. I would eat that.
Yeah. It's going to be fantastic.
Hmm. Cool.
They have that in like with Japanese food that they use the same casks for hundreds of years in the same building. And like the flavor of the food comes from the age of like the wood and the roof and, you know, everything. But I think, Tara, you might be onto something now. This yeah. is very interesting.
Yeah.
Whiskey courgettes.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So.
And sport potatoes. How about that?
Yes. I'll take potatoes anywhere they come.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming.
Welcome.
On the Jazz Podcast, it's been wonderful to talk to you about the, like you say, the most pressing issue of climate change kind of crushes everything else. But then to still have that in the context of being creative and finding a positive energy and a way to, instead of kind of sitting at home, cursing the human race, but to ask yourself, well, what can we do? You know, it's very, very inspiring to listen to. So thank you so much for making the time.
Thanks very much. Thanks, guys.
Can you quickly tell us where people can go and buy your music?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you can go to my website, www.timcliphouse.com. But you can also Spotify and iTunes this album. It's called The Five Elements. And it's, if I have to describe it, I would say it's kind of a mix of neoclassical and jazz. It's had a nice review in the Strad magazine, which of course is a classical magazine. It's got one or two sort of more world music reviews. So reviewers are starting to look at it now, but again, it's a very pigeonholed society. Mm-hmm. So, that's probably the best way to get at it. Or if you see the video on your Instagram or Facebook account, if you're a bit older, you can also just, you know, follow that thread because it will lead back to my website.
You've got a lot of great videos on your website as well.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, there's a few nice things we did, including our previous two albums, which were orchestral albums with, I just want to finish by saying, because of course, my bandmates, they are now in Edinburgh and in Dublin. Nigel, who was in Glasgow then since, found the love of his life in Ireland and moved to Dublin. So we're literally in three different countries. And so with the lockdown, we were not able to get together. So we did everything via Zoom. And then everybody recorded like a pop album separately from their local studios. And I kind of cobbled it all together and then wrote music for the Hilversum musicians, my town in Holland, so that they would get paid for a studio session. And that's what the council was so happy about, that I was giving work to people. Mm. So it is a quite orchestral album. It's the Tim Cliphouse Trio, which is violin, guitar and bass. And then we have some strings, some winds and a pianist. So it's very, well, I like very much what came out. It's very much a mix of styles, and it's music with very filmic qualities, I think.
I listened to it in the bath, and it was fantastic.
Oh, nice. Did you listen to the water movement?
Yes, I listened to the whole thing. I was very wrinkly at the end.
Yeah, it's 30 minutes. You must have been.
I was. But I highly recommend people listening to it in the bath.
Wow, I'm going to do that too.
That's fantastic. What a recommendation. I bet now you're glad you came on the Jazz Podcast.
Certainly am. I'm going to have a bath now.
Fantastic. Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so much fun.
My pleasure.
Great. I'll cut it off there.
Yeah.
Can you send us a track so that we can play it somewhere in the podcast, maybe just 20 seconds or something as a teaser?
Shall I just send you the, the best, what do you need? Just one track?
Yeah, just an MP3 or WAV file.
Send you an MP3. Yeah,
that'd be great. That'd be amazing. Fantastic.
Yeah, thank you, Tim.
Yeah, welcome. Nice speaking to you guys. Thanks, Rob. Some really nice questions there.
Oh, so yeah, great.
What are you up to now, except making this podcast? What else are you doing?
I loved everything you said, because actually, I feel like I'm like what you describe. Like, my job is I just play all this shit and maybe I'm bad at them all, but, the word specialist, it's never really been for me, you know?
Good.
Just trying to, I was like, before I specialize in something, I better be employable. I better play enough instruments that somebody writes like a chair that needs all three. I can actually deal with it. So I'm doing, and also for teaching, that's great, because then I can work with three times more of those students than I could, you know. So actually, quite a lot of teaching is really fun. And like you say, young kids, like my kids, just don't take any crap, you know. I bought these synthetic reeds last week for my instruments. They're they're not cane. They're made of they don't really say what they're made of, you know. They keep it very quiet on the box. But I'm I'm teaching this kid on Saturday, and I'm like, oh, Freddie, you know, I've just tried these reeds. They play dry. They don't need any. They don't need wetting. They don't need warming up. You know, it's fantastic. And he just went, stop right there. This kid's 12, and I was like, what's the problem? He said, that's plastic. Have you thought about the carbon footprint of that reed? I was like, oh, shit.
Him. Wow, he's clued in.
Yeah, they're not afraid to give me a piece of their mind.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so I
videoed that. That the timing of that would have been probably magical.
That was great. He was absolutely no interest in how dry the reed could play or not, you know. Just like, well, what's the environmental impact and have you thought about it?
Ooh, that's so cool.
Yeah, so I've been mostly teaching, but I've been enjoying it, because then the kids I'm working with are very motivated to practice and play, which makes me motivated to practice and play, which makes them, you know, you're kind of just bouncing off each other. That's all they've got. That's all I've got, musically, you know. And I've done a few remote recordings, which, like you say, is it actually has worked better than I ever could have thought it would. But right now, just a mixture of teaching kids and making podcasts is quite nice.
Yeah. Oh, good for you.
It's kind of peaceful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it for me. I quite like a quiet life. So
when's this going to be aired?
This show will be in a month's time, at the end of March.
And Tara, you'll share the link with me so I can share that on my pages and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it'll probably be exactly the 22nd of March, I reckon. Okay. Try and give every show a 2-week window so that our listeners, it's a funny thing. We've got so many shows over such a long time that half the listenership is now, and people will get on me if there's not a show for a while. The other half are people who've just discovered it and are 3 years ago still.
Right.
So there's these kind of two waves going where lots of people, obviously it grows by word of mouth and each guest brings a new fan base. So the older shows that we have still being downloaded quite a lot. So, it's kind of it's great that it doesn't kind of age too fast talking about someone's musical career, you know. So that's the plan, a month today.
Well, Rob, thanks very much for the invite, and Tara, thank you for all of this.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, brilliant.
See you again.
Yeah, right. See you next time we're all allowed to travel.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Great stuff. Speak to you both soon. Bye.
Bye.
Tara, we just listened to that show with Tim. And now we want to talk to you because Dan and I have got nothing to say to each other.
we've managed to do quite well, considering we never have anything to say to each other, Rob, really, do we?
We've done quite well for 4 years of saying nothing all the time for many weeks. Tara, how are you doing? Tell us things.
Oh, God. I've been up since 6:30 with a six-year-old. We've done crafts. We've played ball games. We've done cartwheels.
Are you wearing an apron?
No, this is just a hoodie with a polar bear. Yeah,
that's very lovely. I thought it was just a precautionary apron, you know, in light of the six-year-old. You're babysitting for someone, right?
Yes, my friend is in hospital giving birth to her second child.
Wow!
Which is cool.
Very good.
And we've managed to avoid the whole school fiasco because schools are out now, so bullet dodged there. But yeah, kids are full on, hey.
Yeah, what's it doing now? How have you broken away?
It's watching Octonauts.
Oh, that's so great. The Octonauts must be great because the silence is so impressive.
Yeah, she loves it. And they're 20-minute episodes. And so you don't feel so bad about going for just one more.
Yeah, I love this. Just like, you know, you've got a window. That's excellent. Next week on the Jazz Podcast is the show we recorded with Ayanna Winters.
Yes! Wasn't that good?
It's really good. I'm really excited. It's really annoying sometimes when you've got such a good one and you have to wait like 6 weeks to play it.
Yeah.
You know, you just want to like release it the same day. It was really good. She was very cool.
I actually did some journaling after that because I was so inspired by her.
What did you do?
I just did some, like, writing some thoughts about, you know, because her whole vibe on life was very cool.
You give us a little sneak preview of the vibe.
Yes, we can, by Tara telling us more about this journal she's written.
Yeah. I'm intrigued.
So it's in my, basically, my journal is a garden journal, so that I plant my seeds at the right time, and then I just write my thoughts down. So it's like garden and life.
That's so nice. What have you planted?
Well, last week I planted chilies, tomatoes, courgettes, basil, sage, thyme, all of the good stuff.
And figuratively, and what thoughts did you
plant? Thoughts, figuratively. I loved the way that Ayanna was talking about just allowing good things to come to her. You know, she was talking about writing and these wonderful commissions that she's had and, like, commissions for the LSO. But rather than hustling, they seem to come to her. And, you know, maybe that's just because she's awesome. Maybe there needs to be a level of that kind of skill before you have to stop hustling. But I loved her attitude that good things were going to come and that you didn't have to panic about lack of.
You can empathise with that, Rob, can you?
Dan, I was trying to resist so hard. Genuinely, always, I feel like that if I just stay home long enough, eventually the phone will ring.
The phone will ring, yes.
Yeah. The key is to make sure you're free all the time.
Yeah. You've nailed that one. You've nailed that part, Rob.
Yeah.
All the other saxophonists were already on a gig, so we had poor Rob.
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly what it is. And I'm like one of those, I think I might have said this before, apologies, listeners. The way I think of myself is as one of those fishes that you call a bottom feeder. They like, you know, they swim around at the bottom of the tank and they just eat like all the stuff that the other fish don't want, or they drop it, or it comes out of those fish. You know, quite often that is like the best gigs I've got was somebody else's second choice. You know,
I'm sorry. The other day, Rob, on Twitter, I was a little rude to you.
It was such a burn.
I couldn't resist. I just couldn't resist.
I literally shrieked. It was great.
It's wonderful because it assures people that there's no kind of corporate or personal what's the word? Bias, you know?
Yes.
That can come into play as a result, you know, of running the show and using it for my personal gains. Because if anything, it could only damage but do no good whatsoever, I would think. But I'm glad you said so, because you know what? We should celebrate that we passed 1,000 followers last week.
Oh, yes. Good work, mate.
Which is very, very, I'm very proud of us all, given that we don't have any money and we make this show for fun, you know?
We have a sponsor now.
Yes.
Ah, too good. Presto Music. Thank you for sponsoring the Jazz Podcast. Presto Music are Presto, P-R-E-S-T-O, music.com/jazz. If you want something, go and buy it there.
Yes.
The place to be.
No more Amazon.
No, I was thinking of saying that. I was like, but Presto never told me to bash Amazon every time I say it. That's just my personal opinion.
They get that thrown in for free.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, so CDs, DVDs, high quality downloads, vinyl. What do you need?
Vinyl's having a bit of a resurgence, isn't it?
Mm. Yes. Yes, it is. Have you ever attempted to release an album on vinyl? Have you done one?
I did. The Mermaid album's on vinyl.
Is it now?
It is.
That's wonderful.
Is it available on Presto Music?
Probably not, but maybe we should say hey.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah, okay. Let's get it on their homepage. How was it making an album as vinyl? Fun? Weird? Expensive?
It's expensive. But when I decided I was staying in this country, I bought a record player.
Mm.
That was my setting roots.
Nice.
That's wonderful.
And it'll be 10 years next week.
Wow. Yeah. Decade.
That's brilliant. Nice.
Congrats.
I used to have one that was like a little briefcase that would open, speaker in the front, you know. Really,
they sound
really
awful, but they're really cute.
Really cute, yeah. No bass whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow Dan, George, my cat, has gotten back outside.
I thought you let him in at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, I let him in and kind of shut the doors, and now he's at the door again. I don't remember, that might have been on the edited out half.
Oh, okay.
We did a start, Tara, that was just so bad. I just like
we very rarely
the whole of bashing the, you know, Brexit voters, basically.
Well, in true Jazz Podcast style, we've referenced the parts that we've edited out just to make sure that everybody knows.
Yeah.
Well, it's very rare that we actually edit out.
Yeah, I feel bad because I only ever edit myself when I listen back to things and I'm like, wow, you sound like an idiot.
Anita Wardell didn't realise that we were doing the podcast until the end of the podcast.
Oh, those are the best!
Mm-hmm.
That happened only like three or four ago to me. She was just like, should we start?
Kind of, yeah, but after an hour of chit-chat.
That's so great.
It's a sign of a good interviewer.
Yeah.
Totally. Oh, well.
Fantastic. That's the Jazz Podcast way. Because John Helliwell had a show a couple of months ago for his album Ever Open Door. And in that one, we chatted for an hour. And I asked him really specific questions, like which label it was on, you know, what instruments he plays. And at the end of that, he was like, right, should we do it? Like, in all seriousness, I was like crying with laughter. I was like, as much as I love you, John, those aren't the questions that I personally am like, they're not like the top of the list, you know.
Yeah.
For me, in a personal conversation, you know, what reeds were you playing on that day?
Very good.
Yeah. Before we go, it's the 150th anniversary of the Royal Albert Hall. Oh my God, you've been listening to the Jazz Podcast. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, I assumed it was older, actually.
Well, it's not.
Yeah, it shows what I know. I have no idea.
Oh, I guess it has to be a Victorian era building.